Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. We're always honored that you spend a little time with us here each day. We got a great conversation coming up. We're talking about a pretty important issue, and actually it continues to grow and expand in its influence. And as Christians, we want to see how do we apply biblical worldview to the conversation we're going to have, which is really at the heart of Connecting Faith day by day. How do we see what God's Word has to say and then apply it to our daily life? And in this case, we're going to talk issues of ethics, bioethics, moral reasoning, some of those big topics. But before we get into that, Ted, I thought, you know, there was another Ted who sort of dropped off the radar last night. And I know, you know, there's a lot of people that have some angst about our political process. And rightly so.
Understandably so.
And you look at, well, the choices don't seem that appealing. And, you know, where's our country going and those things. And, you know, I thought about Jeremiah 29. You know, we're familiar with Jeremiah 29:11. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. But, you know, most people don't read the beginning of that chapter because this was a text of a letter that Jeremiah sent to the surviving elders and the exiles in Jerusalem that had been were going to be carried away by Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, 70 years of captivity. And so here's what the letter said. This is what the Lord God Almighty of Israel says to those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper.
A good word.
Yeah. We, you know, who knows what the next years will bring. Maybe it's 70 years of exile for us, too. Who knows?
Right? You never know. God is still on the throne, though, right?
So maybe just review Jeremiah 29, and we know that he has plans for us. But before that, he says, all right, the circumstances you're in, settle down, build houses, marry, have sons and daughters, pray for the prosperity of the city, because if it prospers, you will prosper as well.
So. That's a good word, Neil. Thanks for bringing that today. And, you know, also when it comes to important issues like we're talking about today in bioethics, we have to be prepared with an answer for that. And that's what we're going to get today, right?
It's going to be a great discussion. I'm happy to welcome back Dr. C. Ben Mitchell, who is the provost and the vice president for academic affairs at Union University in Tennessee. He also holds the Graves Chair of Moral Philosophy at the University of Tennessee. And we've talked with him on several occasions in the past, so it's been a while, so we're just really honored to have him back. His list of credentials is pretty substantial. He serves as editor of Ethics and Medicine, an international journal on bioethics. He's a senior fellow in the Academy of Fellows at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, and he previously served there as executive director. He's authored a number of scholarly articles examining the intersection of science and ethics, and has contributed to a number of books. In fact, he has a new book that just came out not too long ago from Brodmann and Holman called Christian Bioethics, and we'll talk about that a little bit as we go along. We do have a couple of copies of one of his earlier works, which is just a short little kind of, I guess, primer, maybe I'd say. It's Ethics and Moral Reasoning, a Student's Guide. And it's part of Reclaiming the Christian Intellectual Tradition. And we've got some copies of that we'll give away during the hour today. So I hope that you will join with us. Give us a call, 877-933-2484. You might have a question or at least sign up for a copy of the book. Dr. Mitchell, great to have you back in Connecting Faith.
It's a great privilege for me, Neil. Thank you for the opportunity to chat with you today.
Well, let's, I mean, you're one of the premier evangelical ethicists in the world today, so let's talk about it. It's been a while since we've talked, and I'm just wondering, it seems like maybe ethical issues and concerns haven't diminished in the least. So where are the front lines today in terms of the tensions about these issues?
Well, the ethical issues have not declined in number. That is certain. I think we could talk about other things that are in declension or in decline, but it's not the number of ethical issues. I mean, we still have the perennial issues like, say, access to basic health care and disparities in health care coverage. We have issues in organ trafficking, not just human trafficking, but trafficking in human organs and tissues like kidney, black market in kidneys around the world. There are all of the range of reproductive technologies from in vitro fertilization to surrogacy arrangements to the buying and selling of women's eggs is still a very important set of issues, genetic modification. The list is almost endless of the number of issues that and problems that we face that are at that intersection between medicine and science and ethics.
Wow, just as you gave that list, you know, some of these things we probably couldn't have even imagined, a dozen years ago. And we are, which I guess brings the question, you know, is the idea of an ethical framework losing traction today? Because, we're championing tolerance at all levels, and it seems higher education particularly has sort of moved into, pretty pragmatic or not really moral-based teaching. So what's your sense of where the direction we're headed?
Well, we're living in an age of cultural moral relativism, and so there are very few absolutes that anyone would affirm, and all of the traditional ethical frameworks are now being contended. So one philosopher ethicist has said we now live in a culture of moral strangers, which I think is a really interesting idea. In other words, we don't have a shared, contentful or full of content moral framework or moral consensus. It reminds you of the scriptural text. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And as you said, the trump card seems to be tolerance. If you tolerate my ethical perspective, I'll tolerate your ethical perspective. And the problem then is we have these violations of basic human rights and basic human dignities, like organ trafficking or like the selling of fetal tissues, and we have to come to some decision about whether we'll tolerate that as a society, and without a moral framework to do that, we're kind of lost, and I think we're feeling that absence now of a moral compass, and we are lost, in fact, as a culture.
You know, you referred to selling of fetal tissue. I mean, that when that story broke, it seemed like it barely got a blip, and then the focus was on the tactics for obtaining the information. What's your sense of what that tells us about our values in terms of how the reaction to that story came about?
It is breathtaking, isn't it? That here you have the dissection of human beings, unborn human beings, and the focus becomes the ethics of exposing or blowing the whistle on the practice, rather than the practice itself. It is breathtaking, and I think it's a diversionary tactic. I mean, I think of Screwtape Letters and C.S. Lewis's great work about the devil's strategies, and I think that's exactly what the devil would expect us, would want us to do, is to be distracted by a secondary issue when the primary issue is so egregious, so awful. So if we could just be distracted by something else, or as you were saying a few moments ago, be distracted by, consumer goods or our own self-interest, then we wouldn't have to worry about these thorny moral questions or ethical issues.
You mentioned C.S. Lewis. Just wondering, is reading somebody like Lewis, or are there some you know, when maybe when you have the opportunity to teach some of the incoming freshmen at Union and they're interested in pursuing bioethics or just understanding moral reasoning, are there some texts that you tend to go back to more often? Is, you know, Lewis one of those that could help us, you know, the general population get a better understanding of pursuing this track?
Absolutely, absolutely. The Abolition of Man, his little book, is a must read for today. It is as relevant today as it was when he wrote it. And then, if you want to see how powerful Lewis's imagination was and how prescient or how prophetic he was about the future, just read That Hideous Strength, the third in his three volume set of novels, science fiction novels. Lewis was extraordinarily keen-sighted about the future, and those are both must-reads, I think, for Christians who are interested at the intersection of science, medicine, biotechnology, and ethics.
We're in the middle of that intersection, and we're not going to, you know, get hit by anything, hopefully, but we are going to direct a little traffic here in the moments ahead and invite you to join the conversation and welcome you to listen in, as well as sign up for a copy of Dr. Ben Mitchell's book, Ethics and Moral Reasoning, A Student's Guide. We've got three copies to give away. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour when we have resources to give away, and it's just a great little primer, giving you an opportunity to help understand this issue a bit more, the broad issues, so that you can perhaps respond to some of the questions that come up in your work conversations or maybe within your own family. You can sign up for a copy of the book and join our conversation with a phone call at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. You can connect with us online as well at myfaithradio.com and then go to the Connecting Faith show page and use the email link there. Ben Mitchell, C. Ben Mitchell, is the provost and the vice president for academic affairs and the Graves Chair of Moral Philosophy at the Union University in Tennessee. He's the editor of Ethics in Medicine, an international journal on bioethics, and he's a senior fellow in the Academy of Fellows, the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, our guest today. We'll talk more in just a moment. Fearfully and wonderfully made, and we have been given dignity and worth and value. We're talking today about human dignity, about bioethics, about the kind of intersection between technology and medicine and science with C. Ben Mitchell. He holds the Graves Chair of Moral Philosophy at Union University in Tennessee. He also is the provost now and the vice president for academic affairs. He edits Ethics in Medicine, an international journal on bioethics. He's also written a couple of books, including Ethics and Moral Reasoning and Christian Bioethics, something new that he co-wrote with Joy Riley from Brodmann Holman. And we're talking today about what we need to know about this ever-changing area. And I guess, you know, technology advancing and science advancing, those are wonderful things, but we want to focus on human dignity a little bit. Maybe we just need to start with that, Ben. How do we define human dignity, and what are the implications if we don't get that definition right?
Well, the implications are huge because human dignity has been the ground that we typically have appealed to for any notion of human rights. And for instance, I mean, you just go down the list: the right to privacy, the right to make decisions for oneself, or what we call self-determination, the right not to be discriminated against. Racism is a violation of human rights and a violation of the notion of human dignity. And you can just go down the line. What I think is instructive and in some ways very frightening to me is that the very notion of human dignity is now under assault. For instance, philosopher Ruth Macklin, who is at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, wrote in a British medical journal just a few years ago that dignity is a useless concept. And then Steven Pinker, that many of your listeners will know, is the neuropsychologist, famous neuropsychologist at Harvard University, wrote the book The Language Instinct. Steven Pinker, during the previous president's administration, said to the President's Council on Bioethics under Leon Cass, the problem is, this is Pinker now, the problem is that dignity is a squishy, subjective notion, hardly up to the heavyweight moral demands assigned to it, which is another way of saying that the notion of human dignity is something which is so difficult to define in Pinker's view that it's meaningless. Now, that's profound. It is a profound statement to say that something which has found its way into nearly every statement of human rights and human protection, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, that notion of human dignity and inherent human value is now under assault in our culture. And what do we make of that? Well, it's just another example of the fact that our moral compass is off course, or another example of what you say at the beginning of the show, that we now no longer can agree on even the most basic ethical principle. So for me, and my understanding of human dignity, as a Christian, of course, is it's grounded. Human dignity is grounded in our being made in the image and likeness of God, and because we've been made in His image and likeness, and every human being's been made in His image and likeness, there are certain moral obligations or ethical obligations I have to others. I should treat them. I should not harm them. I should treat them well. The extension of neighbor love belongs to them. I love the Lord my God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength, and my neighbor as myself, because my neighbor is made in the image of God. And again, as you began the show, the reason that we seek the peace and prosperity and pray for the peace and prosperity of the city is because the city is made up of people made in God's image. So there's a lot at stake here, and to forfeit the notion of human dignity is a very, very dangerous strategy, it seems to me, and endangers the human community. So what is it? Well, it's not functional capacities. Now, what I mean by that is, human dignity doesn't depend upon whether or not I have both of my legs, or whether my mind is working correctly or well, or whether I have certain physical disabilities. One possesses human dignity, or one. We can ascribe human dignity to anyone who is made in God's image from conception through natural death. And that's an affirmation that I think we get from the Genesis account, made in God's image and likeness. And I also think it's an affirmation we get in the coming of the God-man, Jesus Christ, that in Christ we see God has made sacred human embodiment, the human being in Christ.
Which, you know, you mentioned from conception to natural death, that I guess it's probably both of those ends of the spectrum, right, where the most vulnerable are facing the advances in technology and ethics and these things as well, right? I mean, in terms of being under assault, those two.
No, it's exactly right. The late Christian ethicist Paul Ramsey wrote a volume entitled Ethics at the Edges of Life, and those are the edges of life, the beginning of life, the end of life, and that's where the assault is probably most focused right now, and we see it, you know, in the discussions about abortion and fetal tissue, et cetera. And then, of course, at the end of life, with assisted suicide and euthanasia. And again, the claim is that either at the beginning of life, we have an entity that has not yet achieved the status that we call human dignity, or we say, and sometimes even well-meaning people contribute to this idea, that somehow toward the end of life we have lost our dignity. But if dignity is inherent moral worth or the moral worth or ethical value that God has placed upon us, it's not something you gain or lose. It's something you have from the beginning onward.
Let's talk a little bit about maybe we'll start at the beginning. And I know one of the areas that we're seeing technology move rapidly is in the area of reproductive technology. What are the front lines there and the things that we should be concerned about or aware about?
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, let's start before reproduction, and the use of surrogate mothers or the buying and selling of human eggs. That's a significant issue. Women are now being exploited for their body parts. It's interesting. We've had a long discussion in our culture about the objectification of women in pornography, that we're treating women as objects through the images in pornography. Now we're objectifying their body parts. So we're treating the uterus, in the case of a surrogate woman, a surrogate mother rather, we're treating the uterus as that part that is needed to help us achieve our goals of having a take-home baby, or we're treating a woman's eggs as a commodity now that can be bought and sold in a marketplace, so that we can achieve that goal. It's a very, very interesting. It's very, very interesting from an economic perspective, the whole notion of commodification. But from an ethical perspective, women are being exploited for their body parts, and that's a real problem. Then once we get to go ahead.
Well, and this happens globally, right? I mean, some are selling willingly, university students, but it's also
Absolutely.
Happening unwillingly too, right?
Absolutely. Women are being exploited in other countries, either through coercion or most of the time through some kind of monetary coercion to give their bodies for surrogate arrangements. So let's say a woman in India is paid $5,000 to carry someone else's baby to term. Well, that sounds like a lot of money to her because, that in their market, $5,000 could be a year's salary or something like that, or a year's income. But at the end of the day, women are not better off; they're worse off. And it becomes a kind of, biotech slavery that you're buying her goods and services for the use of a couple in a first world country so that they can have a baby. And by the way, I'm in favor of having babies. Procreation's a good thing, but the use of women's bodies in this arrangement is fraught with some tragic moral consequences, I'm afraid.
We'll talk more about it in a moment with C. Ben Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell's provost and vice president for academic affairs at Union University. We're talking ethics and moral reasoning about science, health, and technology. We welcome you to join the conversation at 877-93-FAITH.
As we bear the light of the Son of Man, so there's nothing left to fear. So I'll walk with you in the shadowlands till the shadows disappear. 'Cause he promised not to leave us, and his promises are true. So in the face of all this chaos, maybe I can dance with you.
Andrew Peterson giving us some good words. He's a gifted wordsmith and a singer, songwriter. And you're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're talking about how we navigate the chaos in which we live, particularly as it relates to the intersection of science and health and technology And we're talking with one of the premier ethicists and philosophers in the world today, Dr. C. Ben Mitchell, who's provost and vice president for academic affairs and also the Graves Chair of Moral Philosophy at Union University in Tennessee, joining us today. He edits the Ethics and Medicine International Journal of Bioethics, as well as speaks to centers that deal with the bioethics and human dignity across the globe, really. Works with areas of public policy. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But we were kind of going through. And by the way, I should mention we do have some copies of the short little primer book. It's only, less than 100 pages, I think, Ethics and Moral Reasoning, A Student's Guide. Got some copies of that Ben has written, and we'll give those away at the top of the hour. You can sign up for that with a phone call at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. So we're talking a little bit about, the ethics at the edges, about, the beginning of life and the end of life seems to be where some of these challenges come. We just touched a little bit before the break about surrogate mothers and selling eggs. There's a lot going on in reproductive technology, though, isn't it, Ben? And I'm wondering, is it because we're trying to create the perfect human, or what's the goal?
Well, in some cases, it is the perfect human that we're seeking, and in other cases, it's just avoiding the problems that we associate with imperfect humans. Let me restate it this way. We had in the early part of the 20th century, we had a eugenics movement in this country where we tried to control the breeding, if you will, of human beings, so that we would weed out socially undesirable people, who had disabilities, or those who weren't productive members of society. Now we have a new technology online in reproductive technologies, which allows us to do so either by screening out, say, embryos that might carry various genetic defects, or selecting the kinds of embryos we want to transplant to a uterus, so that we can have the profile of the child that we think is kind of the optimal child. So that's going on, and I think that's worrisome. It's just a new eugenic mindset. It's the idea that I have to have a child that meets my desires rather than receiving those children as a gift from God, and receiving that gift gratefully rather than trying to design the future of our children.
But I guess we should pursue better health, right, and better living. That's something that's a noble cause, isn't it?
Certainly. It's the question of the means to the end. Mm. Certainly, as we care for one another in terms of healthcare and other technologies, we do want to maximize human potentials, and we want to try to relieve human suffering. There's a warrant for that. Jesus healed the sick and cared for those who were hurting, the blind and others. But on the other hand, designing the genetic destiny of our children is a different project. That's usurping the authority that belongs to God Himself, rather than our receiving children as a gift from Him.
Hmm. And of course, another aspect of when it comes to DNA and some of this information, suddenly. Insurance companies and, medical providers, it becomes, these things become weighty, don't they, if we have some sort of strain in our DNA that might not be insurable.
Right. Well, let's say that you have the genetic predisposition or genetic marker for something like Huntington's disease. This is a disease that the symptoms occur usually when an adult is in his or her 50s, and there's a kind of wasting away, if you will, inability to control your movements, and your muscles begin to atrophy. Well, who would be interested in knowing that they had that predisposition? Well, many of us would. Some of us wouldn't. If I were in my college age students here, if I were in my 20s, I don't know at 22 whether I'd want to know that. I might, but I might not. But I know someone who does, and that's your insurance company wants to know that. And now that's being complicated by the fact that our insurance company is now the government. our healthcare is in under Obamacare is now being overseen by the government. So now there's a conflict of interest, it seems to me, or at least the worry of a conflict of interest, because it's the government who's concerned about when you will have these various genetically linked disabilities and what the cost of your care is going to be over time. And the government would have an interest then, if the government's covering your health care, the government has an interest then of reducing the amount of time you would receive that care. And who knows what direction that will go. Will it be the denial of care at certain parts along the way, or will it be the denial of the birth of individuals who have that genetic marker for Huntington's disease?
So is there a day coming when actually those that are maybe weakest among us are going to be actually sort of targeted or, shunned?
Well, I think in some ways that's already happening, not with the same resolution, as it were, of genetics. But for instance, there are those now, especially in Belgium and in other European countries, who are saying that people who have disabilities, especially cognitive disabilities, should have their family should have the right to assisted suicide or euthanasia. They have these disabilities. There are plenty of instances where children who are born with severe genetic disabilities are left not allowed to thrive, so that they die. We have selection processes now that we use in the world and in the culture to be sure that we don't have these burdensome people among us. All the while, we've been working hard to affirm people with disabilities. We even have legislation in the Americans with Disabilities Act to ensure that they are cared for. But on the other end of the spectrum, we're trying to ensure that there are fewer of them. It's a real problem, and one that the disability community is very well aware of, and advocates against typically.
Mm. Well, as you said, we're kind of in this season of conflict of interest. One side of the government is affirming disabilities; the other side, looking rather carefully at how much it costs. So, say a word about what seems to be happening in public policy. I mean, you've spoken before, given testimony before policy-making groups. What's your sense of the guidelines, and what are the arguments that hold up today?
Well, the public policy debate right now is typically driven by crises. So instead of looking forward to see what kind of issues are coming our way, we're more tempted to respond to a given crisis. And the problem with that is someone has said that hard cases or crises like that usually end up making bad policy. You want your policies to be governed by thoughtful reflection, and we've already said that thoughtful reflection about ethical issues in which there is agreement about the basic foundations of those ethical issues is in short supply. Your listeners may want to go sometime to bioethics.gov, the website bioethics.gov, where you'll find, and this is our tax dollars at work, you'll find the work of the current President's Council on Bioethics, and you'll be able to see what some of those issues are that they are dealing with, and get a sense of the direction the policy might follow from there. But back to a couple of crises. I mean, one of the crises, and this is a bioethics issue. One of the crises is whether or not there's a biological cause for sexual orientation. In other words, is there a gene that makes me, or is there a biological condition that makes me homosexual? And we are clearly working through that and at the policy level. What do we believe about biological cause for homosexuality, and what should that dictate with respect to our public policies? And nowhere are we facing this more than, for instance, in higher education, where I'm at currently. We have lots of different policy related discussions and challenges with respect to the LGBT community and the idea that I was born homosexual, therefore I have certain legal rights that I can appeal to.
Well, I was just going to ask you at some point, and it'd be a good time to do it, is there a concern about political, personal, or maybe profit agendas driving research or these conversations, so that, you know, we don't have accurate findings in science, and we don't get honest debate in these conversations?
Sure. There is always a worry that money drives the research agenda. So scientists and most scientists are virtuous men and women. So this is not anti-science what I'm about to say, but scientists need funding for their research, and so they're going to be looking for those who have deep pockets, and in this case, it's typically government who will fund their research. They're going to follow the money, and the sad reality is that in most ethical issues or most ethical problems, money is somewhere at the root of that. And you've heard that expression or said that expression before, follow the money. Well, that's true in ethics too. Follow the money, and you can usually find the problem, or at least the root of the problem, as Scripture says. And there are worries that our research is driven by finances rather than need, and I could give you some examples of that. I mean, there are genetic conditions, for instance, that affect a very small population of people, and yet we still have these huge disparities in healthcare coverage or healthcare provision in the world and around the globe. What's the just allocation or the proper allocation of resources in a case like that? Do we fund research on this small population that is facing these genetic conditions, or do we give it to prenatal care that affects many, many thousands or hundreds of thousands of children in the world? Those are important questions, and money or the allocation of financial resources is right at the heart of the answer to that question.
Well, we're raising some of the questions. We want to come up maybe with some answers, or maybe some questions that we should ask too as we work our way through this. And we'll take a quick break and come back and talk to C. Ben Mitchell in just a few minutes as we get some, hopefully, some answers to some of these important ethical questions. Talking about that intersection between science and health and technology and ethics, where does it all fit in, and what does God's Word have to say about it? Dr. C. Ben Mitchell is Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs and the Graves Chair of Moral Philosophy at Union University in Tennessee. He edits Ethics and Medicine, an international journal on bioethics. He's written several books and contributed to numbers of books and articles. We've got copies of the short little book, Ethics and Moral Reasoning, a student's guide, a little primer that we've got for you. And we'll do a drawing for that at the top of the hour. And you can sign up for that at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Hope, as you've heard the discussion today, you realize that, you know, there's more I need to learn about this to be aware and be prepared. So we'll talk how can we kind of frame our biblical worldview to answer some of these questions coming up in just a moment. Stay tuned. Loves us. He created us, the abilities, the uniqueness that each of us have. fearfully and wonderfully made. We live in a world today that doesn't necessarily value human dignity. In fact, there's maybe some war on dignity. It's under assault, as we've been learning today with Dr. C. Ben Mitchell, who is provost and vice president for academic affairs at Union University in Tennessee. He's written a couple books, his latest called Christian Bioethics, along with Joy Riley from Broadman. We've got a couple of copies of Ethics and Moral Reasoning, a student's guide. He wrote that some years ago. And we're giving the other way here at the top of the hour. We're talking about raising some of the questions in today's world of science and health and technology and education and ethics. So, Ben, we've kind of raised some of the questions, but can you help us maybe as a little primer, give us a help us build a biblical worldview, or maybe some of the questions that we ought to ask when these issues come up and they become water cooler conversation at work?
Sure. I mean, I think, first of all, we have to affirm and try to recover or rehabilitate the notion of human dignity. And I think we do that by showing people what is at stake, show them that our understanding that every man, woman, boy, and girl should not be discriminated against on the basis of the color of their skin, that's due to our understanding of human dignity, that basic human rights, a right not to be enslaved or to be in slavery, is rooted and grounded in a notion of human dignity. We have to remind people how important this notion is. And then I think one of the ways, especially the Christians, do this is not only by our advocacy in the public marketplace of ideas, but also in the way we treat one another. We should treat one another as if we have inalienable dignity based upon God making us in His image and likeness. Or another way to put it is that we believe that the sanctity of human life isn't just about the beginning of life, but it's also about life now, that every human being is a sacred vessel made by God. Secondly, I think we have to follow that very first principle of medicine and ethics, which is do no harm. We must avoid harm to human beings at every point along the continuum from conception to natural death. We'll have to have a conversation about what harm means in some cases, but most of the time it's clear. We mean you ought not kill unjustifiably. You should not subject people to, say, experimentation without their permission and consent. You shouldn't subject them to medical treatments without their consent. Protecting the right to life is a principle that I think most of your listeners will understand and is grounded again in the notion of human dignity. And then I would say, as you were pointing out, Neil, treatment of the vulnerable is critical. We have to show mercy to and care for those who are most vulnerable. That includes the unborn. It also includes the dying. We have to do a better job as a church. We have to do a better job as Christians of caring for those who are dying. That's a way to honor human dignity made in God's image. I remember Chuck Colson, the late Chuck Colson, saying, I guess it was about 2008. He said, in these troubled times, he believed the church's greatest calling was to uphold human life and human dignity. And I think, and it was Francis Schaeffer, the late Christian philosopher and apologist, who said that a society is measured by its treatment of the vulnerable, its care for the vulnerable. I'm afraid that we're not measuring up, as it were.
We're pretty focused on pragmatism, aren't we? That's the end, bottom line.
We're focused on pragmatism. We're focused on ourselves. I mean, a selfie is not just a picture we take with our smartphone. We live the life of selfies in our culture right now. We're self-obsessed. We are self-focused. I think getting out of ourselves and caring for others is the remedy for at least that illness among us.
You're one of the Academy of Fellows at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity down in the Chicago area. They have a conference every year that's coming up in June about transformations in care. Just you want to say a word about that, or in particular, if people want to find more information, are those the kind of places that could be something to look into?
Yes, there are a huge number of resources at cbhd.org, Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. There are bibliographies. There are articles. There is a newsletter called Dignitas, the notion of dignity. And there is information about the upcoming conference. The conference not only has some of the principal and premier ethicists in the country speaking at it, like Bob Orr, a physician who's probably done more clinical ethics consultations than anybody I know, but also can be taken for credit. Trinity has an MA program in bioethics that would allow people to take this conference and some wraparound courses for credit. So this is a great way to both extend your knowledge and then also develop credentials that could help you serve on, say, your hospital ethics committee or be a resource to your pregnancy care center in different ways than you might be able to otherwise. And so there are lots of opportunities here, or even work with a local hospice in their ethics education program. So there are resources there at cbhd.org, as well as information about the upcoming conference.
And I would think even there may be some, parents listening with high school graduates thinking, well, what's the major going to be? Probably majoring in this area is certainly going to be a growing and much needed field for biblical influence.
There are jobs in the area, in the area of bioethics, usually working in a teaching hospital or a medical school. But in addition to that, we had a number of students take a gap year between college and medical school to do the MA in bioethics. And furthermore, these courses were always offered and are offered on a modular basis, so clinicians, that is, those who are practicing medicine, nursing, law, and other educators can take these courses during their regular jobs. They can come to Chicago for a couple of weeks during a semester, a couple of weekends, sorry, during the semester, and do these courses. One of the head ethicists and neurologists at the Mayo Clinic, Bill Cheshire, has an MA in bioethics from Trinity International University.
Well, may your tribe increase, Ben. Thank you for the work you're doing, and I'm sure if we talked again 5 years down the road, we'd have a whole new set of things to talk about that we couldn't have imagined today.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure. Your work in getting the word out to the average person like us makes a huge difference, and we need that information. So thank you for being a vehicle for that information.
Well, you can start with a simple address, website, cbhd.org. It stands for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. There are a lot of Trinity helpful resources available there. Dr. Ben Mitchell serves in Union University. He's the provost there and the vice president for academic affairs and has been teaching in moral philosophy for a number of years, joining us today on Connecting Faith. Ben, blessings to you. Thanks so much for the good work you're doing, and look forward to chatting with you again down the road.
Same to you. Thank you.
Ben Mitchell joining us today on Connecting Faith. If you missed part of the program, want to hear it again, or maybe pass it on to a friend and you can create some dialogue about it. You can always find them posted online at myfaithradio.com and go to the Connecting Faith show page, myfaithradio.com, and then click on Connecting Faith, and you'll find this interview posted here after the show and a host of others as well to talk about. I want to just remind you, of course, tomorrow, National Day of Prayer, and I encourage you to be listening tomorrow during the Connecting Faith Hour when we spend some time talking about prayer for those in leadership over us, and what does it mean to seek a confession on behalf of others when it wasn't our sin that was involved. Brian Chappell is coming back with us. He's going to help us from the life of Daniel learn about prayer in these challenging days in which we live. Also want to mention, too, the studio audience, looking for a live audience on May 19th. You can sign up at myfaithradio.com. And we should probably say happy wedding to Carissa coming up here in just a few days.